previously on the Ron Van Dam Show.
This is embarrassing. You should not be listening to this show. What the hell is that about? The hell are you doing?
And now, today's episode.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
That's nice. That's nice.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Great.
Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
If I could find the guy that invented allergies. Oh, man. Killing me, man. I got allergies up to you-know-what today. I'm stuffed. I'm stuffed. I feel like a turkey. I'm stuffed. My eyes are watering. My crotch is itchy. I don't know if that's allergies with the crotch itchy thing. That's a different problem. Can you catch allergies? Because I didn't have allergies all through my life until I got older, and then all of a sudden I started having allergies, and I think I probably was talking to somebody who had allergies, and I somehow contracted it from that person. Now I'm out to find two individuals. The guy that contracted allergies to me, and the guy that invented allergies. I won't eat birthday cake. Oh no. That's because just before I have a slice of birthday cake, somebody I don't know has just blown all over the top of the cake with their disgusting breath. Probably spittle came out of their mouth and found a home on the top of the icing on the cake. I ain't eating that crap. I like to find a girl who had relations with a lot of other girls, because the saying is, if you have sex with a girl, then you've literally had sex with all the people the girl has had sex with. So that'll up my numbers considerably. That doesn't make any sense, does it? I was quite a promiscuous young man. No more. But I was. Oh my God, was I promiscuous? It's not that I had sex with everybody in sight. No. Not everybody. I had a little New York City apartment in Queens, New York, Elmhurst, New York. It was a tiny little studio apartment, and I was a movie theater manager for a very large premier movie theater in Manhattan, right across the street from Bloomingdale's and other theaters as well, was I manager of. So I could let all the pretty girls in for free because I was the manager. And I don't think I was supposed to do that, but I was a young bachelor kind of guy. So I did it. As a result, I was quite popular. Hey, that guy over there, if you're nice to him, he'll let you in for free.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, that was quite interesting. Quite an interesting young life I had. But, you know, now I'm older and wiser. Well, I'm older. And now I live my life like a stick. I'm very, why am I telling you about me? That's rude of me. Tell me about you. What were you like when you were younger, when you were a young adult? Were you wild and crazy? No? Oh, I thought you would have been. You look like you were. Maybe it's because your hair is all mussy. Mussy. When I was growing up, hairspray was the big deal. Everybody had hairspray, even men. But women would literally take an entire case of 12 cans of hairspray. And they would just, whatever hairstyle they had, they would just hairspray this thing into a frozen structure. It was very, very odd. If you touched a woman's hair when I was growing up, it could be brittle and it could break. It was just, hairspray was the big thing. And everybody smelled the hairspray too, because hairspray had an odor to it. It was like chemicals with a fragrance to hide the chemicals. So you would have a combination of chemical smell and fragrance smell. It was absolutely disgusting. Also during my time, women ironed their hair. Oh my God. Not their clothes. No, their clothes weren't ironed, but their hair was. Every woman had an ironing board in her apartment or wherever she lived, and she would iron her hair so that it was extremely straight. The thought of anybody ironing their hair now is like crazy. It's like sending your hair out to the dry cleaners, you know? I like my hair starched, please, ironed and put neatly in a box. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's what they iron their hair. So there was the straight hair, and there was the many cans of hairspray, and that was how we grew up. Now, to me, from what I'm seeing, the look is messy. You want the messy look. You want to look like you did nothing to your hair. This is like makeup. You know, I talked about that yesterday. Women put makeup on to hide their face, like they're going into clown performance at a circus, but you're not supposed to see their face. That's punishable by law. So you cover it up, you say. So you want to look natural, put a lot of makeup on, and still look natural. That's a feat that I don't think anybody can really pull off that well. But now the hair look is the hot mess. It's the look is to look like you did nothing to your hair whatsoever. Like you just woke up out of bed and you looked in the mirror and most people go, oh my God. Now that's a hairstyle. That's a thing. That's I look horrible. Perfect. The hot mess. The look of I didn't do a thing with my hair. Which I guess is convenient. You don't have to carry a brush. See, guys can't carry brushes because it sticks out of their pocket and you're not sure what's going on down there. Guys can only carry combs, but they don't do that either anymore because it's the natural whatever look. Hey, your hair's all messed up. Wow, that's the look. What are you talking about? Get with the program, honey. Ooh, he called me honey. Where did that come from? Some of these pet names are really odd. Honey, I guess, is like one of the oldest pet names ever. You're calling somebody a sticky fluid. It's no, honey is, of course, very sweet, and you are very sweet, so I call you sweetie. Our terms of affection have a lot to do with sugar and molasses and stuff. We like to call each other sticky sweet names. I love you, syrup. Did you just call me syrup? I don't know. It's sticky. It's sweet. What do you want from me? We call people strange names. Snookums. What the hell does that mean? What is a snookum? That's, I don't even know what that is, but we call people that. A snookum could be a horrible thing. Yeah, I was out in the woods and this gigantic beetle came around and I stepped on it and there were snookum all over the ground. Don't step in a snookum. People call each other snookum. I don't know what that means. Deer is a very affectionate name. Deer is actually the first word in a letter. Dear Bob, dear Marcia, hello, dear. Wait, did you forget my name? I don't remember your name. I remember the first word in a letter, but that's about it. Deer is great if you don't know anybody, if you don't know their name. Like at a cocktail party, you're introduced as, Ron, this is Mary Ann. Hi, Mary Ann. And then five minutes later, she comes up and, are you enjoying the party? Yes, I am. Snookums, honey, it's Mary Ann. I can't remember names. These terms of endearment. Yeah, cocktail parties are very, very odd for me, especially the ones where they have the little name badges. And the name badges have, it's hello, my name is, and then they print your name in there. And it's always somebody from the organization that can't print really well. Those are the people that write your first name in there. You know, from the printing store, it's hello, my name is. That's very clear. That's very bold. But then there's a scribble. I can't even read the thing. It's some person that has horrible handwriting or extreme arthritis. It's very embarrassing. It makes me feel like I'm in kindergarten or first grade. Bobby, let's march around the classroom. Come on, Bobby. That's what it reminds me of. This is this very pure, childish kind of, wear a name tag, wear a name tag. Name tags are stupid. Sometimes they wear in restaurants, the servers wear a name tag. I don't know why. Am I supposed to call a server by their first name? I think that's a little familiar. I think hey you is a little bit more appropriate under the circumstances. Or excuse me, you don't have to say their name. Excuse me, Joseph. Do I know you? Well, it says Joseph on your name badge, so I'm calling you Joseph. Yeah, don't. We don't know each other. I'm your server. You're going to tip me and we're going to be done. So let's not strike up any kind of familiar name calling here. They make me wear this badge, but it's stupid. When women wear the name badges, it's always embarrassing because the name badge is either the hello, my name is, or a actual name badge is usually placed just above the left tit. And so as a guy, in order to find out who I'm talking to, I need to basically stare at your breast to read your name. If you could put that somewhere else, we wouldn't have a problem here. And it's not that I can just glance down and see your name on your breast. It takes me time. I have to get out my reading glasses. I have to get within about half a foot of your breast in order to read your name properly. Nice to meet you, May. No, that's Mary. Sorry, I couldn't get close enough to your breast. It's a horrible place to put them. So I go to cocktail parties and I read women's breasts. That's what I do for a living. It's just embarrassing. It's horrible. And we've talked about on this show, I'm just terrible at small talk. And you probably are. Well, I know you're terrible at small talk because most of you I do small talk with and you're terrible at it too. You're even worse than I am. It's beautiful weather. This is like the first nice day we've had in weeks. What? What do you work with the weather department? What? Yeah, thanks for stating the obvious. That's the funniest of all, is when you're doing small talk with somebody, they walk up to you and they go, it's raining hard outside. It's really raining outside, isn't it? Yes, it is. Where are we going from here? Because I'm simply agreeing with an observation that is quite obvious. The stupidest is when someone comes up to you and they're soaking wet. No umbrella. They're soaking wet. They've been caught in this gigantic rainstorm. And the first thing they say to you is, "It's raining out there, isn't it?" I wasn't sure. I thought you were just sweating profusely. Or you decided to take a shower with your clothes on just before you came to the cocktail party, which is bad timing and also not advised. "Yes, it is raining outside, Captain Obvious. Thanks for bringing that information in for me. Are the winds from the southeast at 26 miles an hour, huh? What's it going to be like tomorrow? Partly cloudy with a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon? What's the outlook for the winter? Are we looking for a snowy, cold winter or what? Weather person." Want to pull out the map and let me know the extended weather forecast for the next 10 days? Because your weather report that it's really raining out, isn't it, is not exactly the most professional weather report. Let me just stare at your breasts for a couple of minutes and find out what your name is. Why do they stop there with the name tags, with just the name? Why don't they also have a short bio on your name tag? Marianne, long walks in the park, romantic dinners, hiking, poetry. That's a huge name tag you have.
I have a lot of hobbies.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I try to avoid large gatherings of people for so many reasons. There's just so many. When there's too many people, they bump into you. That's a clue that there's too many people. If you ever go to a party and you have to say, excuse me, I just want to get by, excuse me. That's too many people. I don't like the excuse me thing. I'm not to be excused. I'm just trying to get over to the drinks. It's real. My entire goal at a cocktail party is, where are the drinks? I mean, I personally cannot talk to anybody at a cocktail party without a cocktail in my hand. I don't know what to do with my hands. I can't just stand there with my hands folded in front of me or behind me. It's kind of stupid. You got to have a drink in your hand. You don't even have to drink it. Just carry it around. And if you can find a martini glass, bring one with you. And just fill it with water and say it's vodka. You know, put an olive in it. No one will know the difference. No one's going to say, "Can I have a sip of your cocktail?" No one does that. They shouldn't be doing that. And you shouldn't let people take a sip of your cocktail. You don't know where they've been. Don't let anybody put their lips on your glass. Ugh. 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 I also have a problem with parties, especially when they're outdoors, where they have potato chips, potato salad, coleslaw, all these cold salads that have been sitting out in the sun for 6 hours. I know that they're riddled with bacteria. I'm not going to eat that stuff. I also don't know the people that prepared that particular dish. They have this thing called potluck. That means everybody brings their own tray of something that they made at home, driving 6 hours in the car with that tray of food in the back seat. And then they bring it to the party, and you're supposed to have a taste of it and supposed to eat it. Not me, my friends. I don't know you. I don't think you put poison in it, but I'm not sure about your quality control. If you dropped the entire tray of food on the floor and then, oh no, and picked it up and put it back in the tray, I don't know what that crap is. I don't know how you made it. I don't know how you dealt with it. I don't know how you transported it here. I'm not eating it. I'm certainly not eating it. I'm not putting my hands in a bowl of potato chips that other people have, with their dirty, scummy little hands, have touched other chips in the bowl. Probably touched my chip by osmosis. Now, I'm not eating your stuff. And they call it a potluck party, a potluck dinner. What does that mean? Potluck? It's like, you can eat that food, good luck to you. hope you survive. That's a potluck there. Good luck. No, I don't think you understand. That doesn't work for me. What does work for me is my next guest. We're going to talk about entitled people. I think that's the bottom line here. It's people that pay their way into college. And you know that, I said college. You know that with what's in the news, with the Full House woman and her little entitled housewife friend, that, yeah, they try to get their kids in college by paying people off to get their kids in college and lying about their background. Their kids are stupid, but they're entitled. So for impressive reasons, they must go to the finer schools. The Full House lady there, I think it was like Caltech or University UCLA or something, paid money to get their kid into the, I don't know, choose a better school if you're going to start paying money out. My God, it's like ridiculous. Anyway, I have problems with entitled people. People get what they deserve, not what they throw money at. I don't like that. I don't like that thing. Other people are working hard and studying, and these rich people just throw a couple of dollars and, here, take my kid. Here's a couple of bucks under the table. It's not right. It's not right because most people don't have those bucks to put under the table, and even if they did, that's a wrong way of getting your kid into a school. So we will talk to our guest momentarily, but first a commercial word because, you know, you got to have commercials these days.
Hey, this is Bobby Marone, former heavyweight contender. But I hung up my boxing gloves to open the area's favorite new restaurant.
It's Headshots, Bobby.
Headshots. Hey, this month we're starting something new at Headshots. It's our all-you-can-eat, nothing-but-meatball brunch. That's right. You can come to Headshots and load up on all your favorite sausage.
Meatball?
Right. Meatballs. It doesn't matter what kind of chicken you like.
Meatball?
What kind of meatball you like. We got it at the all-you-can-eat, nothing-but-typewriters.
Meatballs.
Nothing but meatball buffet. You heard me right. No pasta, no cacciatore, no lasagna, just delicious lasagna.
Meatballs.
However you like them. Traditional, hot and spicy, stuffed with cheese, covered in marinara. My mouth is watering just thinking about eating all these cheerleaders.
Holy sh... Meatballs.
Eating all these meatballs myself. So what are you waiting for? Get on down to Headshots and see if you can eat more General Gao's chicken than me, Bobby Marone. That last one was supposed to be meatballs too, huh?
Yeah.
Good morning, Ron.
Rich Colgar joins us now. He's written a book called Late Bloomers. Interesting stuff, because I'm on the same page, so to speak, with you as far as education is concerned. Let's start at the beginning. There's been this college admissions scandal going on and kind of opened up the door for discussion about higher education and what people do in order to achieve the ultimate version thereof. That's kind of what your book is about, I think.
Well, it is. Now, the book was going to press when this college admissions scandal broke in March, so I didn't write about that. But when you think about it, it's in its own perverse way, the logical conclusion of people willing to do anything to get the quote-unquote most elite degree that they can for their kids. And even, you know, where I live in Silicon Valley, educated middle-class families talk casually of spending $50,000 over a four-year high school career to give their kid the edge through tutoring and test preparation.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that you make the comment that we're trained to feel that if our kids don't get into the best institute of education, then we've failed. And Man, that's extreme.
Well, it is. And parents today are, they're chewed up about this. They don't know whether to apply more discipline to their kids or less. And they feel the stakes are so high. And maybe they are high, but that's a fault of society and the way we put overemphasis on early education and test scores and grades and where you went to school, because it's created, you know, people are spending exorbitant amounts of money on tutoring and test prep and this is more of a big city phenomenon, and they are you see this everywhere. People are taking on way too much debt to go to school when they could have gone, you know, they could have gone to their local community college for one, and then gone on to a 4-year school, but really only spent 2 years at a 4-year price. Or one of my college roommates is a clinical psychologist in Los Angeles, and he treats families that often come in with a troubled teenage kid, and oftentimes the troubled teenager is a perfect teenager, except they don't sit still in school.
Yeah,
and they're not on the college-bound track. You know, in fact, they love fixing cars and stuff like that.
Sure.
And, you know, perfectly normal kids, and their parents are worried sick about them.
I never understood this. I don't think you have to go to Harvard or Yale or some expensive school in order to get a job. I don't think that's the case. In fact, I've known many cases where someone seems to be overeducated because they came from a place where they think, well, we'll hire them. They're just going to go somewhere else because they're from Harvard. They don't need us. It's almost like, hasn't it gone over too far on the other end here? And you made the comment that somebody who's good at fixing cars can make a lot of money, kind of more than someone that went to a 4-year expensive college. I don't understand how we fell into this mindset.
Yeah, and that and that trained mechanic, by the way, can always go to college later, and
sure,
if they do, they probably have a much greater focus about what they want to do.
I guess.
Or they can build a business around it.
Yes.
I mean, we vacation every year in Indian Wells in the Palm Springs area after Christmas, and we rent a condo from a plumber, you know, who happens to own a plumbing firm that employs a lot of people.
Exactly.
But we're spending way too much on edge on this mistaken belief that everybody should have the most elite degree that they should. And Carol Dweck, to your point earlier, Carol Dweck, who teaches freshman psychology at Stanford, wrote a great book called Mindset, and she talks about the difference between a fixed and a growth mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these early achievers, many of the ones she sees as freshmen at Stanford, they already have the fixed mindset about their capability.
Mm-hmm.
She calls them exhausted and brittle, and they don't want to mar their perfect records. Now, do you really want to employ somebody like that?
No. It's kind of more about the parents than it is about the kids, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I think the college bribery scandal, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're surrounded, particularly if you're in the, you know, Northern California or Boston or New York or Seattle or some of these places where there are these big, successful tech companies and investment banks and places like that, then it becomes even more extreme, because these big tech companies and investment banks are notorious for hiring only from a limited range of universities.
Yeah. I mean, I've often joked that why don't the parents just give the school, you know, like a diploma costs like $40,000. Okay, here's $40,000, or here's your diploma, that's it. Because kind of that's what it is. I mean, it really, I don't know how much of an education one gets. And when I go to a doctor's office, a physician, they went to a college I never heard of, but they're a physician and they're working. I don't know how we got to this point where...
They'll develop their reputation soon enough, particularly today where, you know, on Yelp and everywhere else, the word gets out. So they're either going to be good or they're not going to be good. And the fact that some of them went to, you know, South Alabama, you know, medical school, well, I think my internist did, and he's a great one.
Yeah, but my point is, it's not really for the child's embetterment. It's for the parents to be able to say, my kid went to this school, and this is the paper that we got.
Yeah, I think it is that. I think that we've created so much pressure, and it isn't, you know, it may be as cynical as that with some parents. They're looking at their kids as trophies, but I think for most, it's sort of a pressure. They feel like, well, you know, if we don't do this, then we're not doing the best for our kid. Yeah. Whereas, in fact, doing the best for your kid might be just listening to your kid and getting to know your kid and getting to know whether they're really going to thrive with this kind of pressure, because many kids aren't.
Yeah.
My heart breaks for the kid, you know, who grows up and he could, you know, he may have native gifts to be a great carpenter or an artist or a musician, but all that kid knows is that he can't sit still in school and the school judges him as some kind of a loser. And then the parents get panicked about that and double down on the tutoring.
Let's talk for a second about SATs and all that stuff, because I know your book talks about early achievement. And in your book, you say that if you take a look at the SATs and why they were created, we've given a lot of importance to something that was, I don't think, meant to end up like this.
Well, yeah. Alfred Binet developed the IQ test, a real short test in France to figure out why some little French school children were falling behind. It was a Stanford psychologist, Louis Terman, who imported it into the United States in the 1916, came out with the U.S. version much longer. And Terman thought this is like the Holy Grail. This is how you could measure people and fit them for their perfect life and for society's perfect life. The flaw, of course, is all the early IQ testers like Terman and then Carl Brigham, who developed the SAT as kind of an extension of the IQ test in 1926, they were all part of the eugenics movement. I mean, that's just plain. There is no denying it. They are just trapped by their own record, their own statements. And that, you know, that was the idea that people with a Northern European background were superior to people of successive darker hues of color as you went south toward the equator and below. And I mean, the extreme eugenics movement, actively discouraged breeding among the swarthy people. And so this is built into the SAT from the very beginning by way of the IQ test.
Yeah.
So Carl Brigham, at least, the Princeton creator of the SAT test, had profound regrets about his creation. He only died 8 years later in middle age, and he said before his death, he said, "We have committed a great sin, and the test is a glorious fallacy."
Wow!
Its own creator.
Well, says more than anybody can actually say. The book is called "The Late Bloomers: The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement." It's fascinating, and I'm glad that you wrote it. I haven't seen anything like this, to be honest with you. It's very good. It might put us back to where we should be mentally on this whole subject matter. It's available everywhere, I assume.
It is.
And how do we keep in contact with the author? Is there a website?
Yeah, you can go to my website, Rich Karlgaard, that's RichKarlgaard.com. And write me a note. Send me your own late bloomer story. I'm just fascinated by people who find unconventional paths to successful and fulfilled lives.
Yes, and your book is full of examples where people who didn't go that this game route turned out to be more successful than one could possibly ever imagine. There's plenty of stories like that and plenty of examples as well. It's called Late Bloomers.
Yeah, from big-time financial managers to big-time coaches. I mean, and artists galore. So.
Yeah. It's not all about what we think it is. It's been a pleasure, Rich. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for giving me your time, Ron.
Okay, take care.
Okay.
That'll do it for me today. I'll do it for you, too. I'm done. I am cooked. I'll be back again tomorrow with a brand new show. I hope you join me then. Until that time, I wish you peace.